Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. A new version was released, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Manton, I have an iPhone 4 in my pocket. How about you?
I have one sitting on my desk.
Oh, okay, now I'm holding it. I was inspired by talking about it, too. Take it out and hold it.
Whoa, be careful how you hold it.
Hey. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm losing connection here. Good thing we're not running the Skype over the iPhone 4.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's, wow, what a PR, just stupid nightmare for Apple. I mean, I know some people are saying that it's being overblown, but it's one of those things where, I don't know, it doesn't seem like Apple's helping matters at all by just poo-pooing the fact that, you know, there's a demonstrable issue for people.
Yeah, at first I thought it was overblown because I picked up my iPhone at the Apple store and then I walked over to work at a coffee shop for a couple hours, and it's one of those things where reception was great there. I tried to reproduce the issue. I couldn't. I was like, some people have this problem. I don't. No big deal. But then I got home where my house is like a notorious dead zone, you know, from AT&T, and the problem is pretty bad. I can't hold the phone in my, you know, in that way and expect to do anything. So it's too bad. I mean, the phone is amazing. It's the best phone I've ever seen, but it really tarnishes that one little part.
Yeah, I find it pretty annoying too. I probably end up getting the bumper, even though I don't really want the bumper. But
yep.
At this point, I'm holding out, thinking, well, if I have this, you know, $600-$700 phone, and I don't really want to buy the bumper now if Apple's going to give them away as part of a settlement or something, right?
Well, that's the thing, is why haven't they just started giving them away right away? I mean, why aren't they free right now is what I want to know. And the thing that, I mean, I'm not upset about it, but the thing that's funny about the bumper is that it's $30.
I know.
For a little piece of plastic.
A rubber band.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not one to complain about pricing.
I mean, unless it's insane. Price.
Unless it's totally nuts, right? I mean, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen, and it's bad enough. But now that we know that the bumper fixes this issue, the $30 is just like a punch in the face.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, I was chatting with some people about this online, and somebody mentioned, well, Apple doesn't want to give away all these bumpers because that's expensive. Right. And they used the math of $30 times every, you know, iPhone 4 sold. But of course, mm-hmm. the bumper only costs Apple like a quarter, I'm sure. It's got to be the craziest markup ever. It's really not much different amount of plastic, rubber, whatever, from like one of those Livestrong arm bracelets, you know,
mm-hmm.
and those they charge $1 for
the whole dollar goes to charity,
a huge
right?
Profit, right? Right. So, I don't know, Apple, step it up. Just this is how we are. Apple customers are, really kind of lenient when it comes to the company, right? Because I paid, you know, hundreds of dollars, really, even though it's subsidized through my plan. I paid for this phone that's hundreds and hundreds of dollars. It's a really, really expensive phone.
Mm-hmm.
And to have it just have this, like, comical defect is, you know... And what's up with this? Apple claimed it was a software issue. And I have to admit, I sort of went for that at first because I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll cut them some slack if it's really just a case of the bars going from, like, what should be showing is two bars down to one bar,
mm-hmm.
then that certainly changes the situation a bit. I think I can accept that there is a way to hold my phone that's going to, you know, slightly compromise the reception. But they said this was a, you know, a software, but what, they haven't fixed that, right? I mean,
they haven't fixed it yet. They implied or said maybe that a software update, like a 4.01 release, was coming soon. Like,
well,
I'm surprised we haven't seen
right,
it yet.
If you have, you know, a software fix for an issue that is basically just being causing your product to be dragged through the gutter daily. You know, it's getting worse and worse, and now it's on. I saw a clip online from, you know, national evening news covering it. You know, it's like, of course, nobody watches that anymore except for, I guess, on little clips online. But I don't know. It seems like a...
Well, it's definitely it's a huge PR thing. I mean, a week or maybe even less after I bought the phone, I was in the grocery store and I got it out to check something and someone came up like, oh, is that the new iPhone? How do you like it? And I started to talk about how great it is, the screen and the camera and all this. And then they interrupted me, but what about the reception? You know, is it, can you talk on it? And it's like, everybody knows about this problem and it becomes the story of the phone that this major problem is, you know, even if it's kind of minor compared to how great the rest of the phone is.
It's true. That is exactly why I'm baffled that, this is one of those cases where it's hard not to picture Apple as just like this oblivious entity, right? Just like, why doesn't everybody like the phone? You know, and it's,
what's wrong?
I can sort of relate to that. Like from a business point of view, you know, I don't want people to zero in on the defects of my products and to the exclusion of everything that's great about them. But
yeah,
God, it's just like, you got to own up.
It's a good thing this isn't the first generation phone. Like, we're at the fourth generation. It's basically unstoppable. I mean, the phone is so popular and so entrenched. But if you think back on, like, I was thinking about other PR disasters from Apple. Like, remember the original Newton, the handwriting recognition was not great, and they could never recover from that, even though they fixed it, even though it was way better in the next rev. You know, the story of the Newton became, it's a joke, you can't write on it, and it doesn't work. I don't think that's going to happen here. Like I said, the phone's amazing. It's been out for a few years, but it's the same kind of thing where the narrative becomes about this issue instead of the rest of the good stuff about the phone.
Yep. I think you nailed it there. It's even for me as a happy owner of the phone, I have to admit that I associate, you know, iPhone 4 antenna problem. And
right.
I know that a lot of Apple defenders online are like, are basically getting annoyed with people who keep bringing this up, but it's one of those situations where you keep bringing it up, and I'm glad that Consumer Reports is making a stink about it, and I'm glad that the evening news is on it, because it's one of those things where Apple's resistance to acknowledge a problem, to me, is challenging the public to keep bringing it up. You know, it's like if you just say, you know what, we did have an oversight here. There's something wrong here. Either we're going to fix it, or, you know, our solution is to buy a case or whatever. If they said, you know, it's true, there's an antenna problem, we're sorry, but you just have to pay the $30 and buy the case. That would be it would suck, but it would be a completely different scenario. And I think people would stop harping on it. They'd grumble, yep. And then they'd be like, well, Apple's not perfect. They screwed this one up. Hopefully the iPhone 4.1 will have this fixed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, hopefully they act relatively quickly. And hey, free bumpers for everybody. Yeah. That's the solution.
Right. Well, you know, speaking of the iPhone 4, I was going to be, you know, if we would have recorded a couple days ago, you would have caught me with my iPhone 4 completely hosed. I don't know if I think I mentioned this to you off the podcast, but
yeah, what happened?
It's probably a coincidence, but you know, we're talking about this like possibly defective antenna and talking about how great the phone is in general. This is the first phone I've had spontaneously die on me. And it's probably a coincidence. I'm sure this has happened to people with iPhone 3s, but you know, I've only had it for, like everybody else, 2 weeks or whatever, right? And cruising down the street. Admittedly, my phone was barely charged. It was one of these situations where it had been discharged. I plugged it in for like 20 minutes and then took it out, you know, on a walk. So I'm, of course, walking down the street, checking Twitter, as usual. And
run into a brick wall, trip over your own feet.
I'm leaving the house for 20 minutes. What if something happens on Twitter? So, so there I am refreshing, and the phone does its like, we warned you many times that you're under a 10% charge. Now we're just going to like spontaneously shut down and die. That's fine. But then I get home, I plug it in, and you know, it does its normal charging thing where it doesn't let you use it because it's not charged well enough. And sooner or later, I realize that every time I turn it on, even after it's been charged for hours, it just brings up that Apple logo. And after a few seconds, goes blank again, and then brings up the Apple logo again, goes blank. So it sort of looks like it's cycling in a constant reboot cycle.
Yeah.
So I plug it into iTunes, thinking, come on, I got to be able to like, I got Xcode and everything here. Surely something can get me this thing back restored. But the darn thing will not even show up. And so I finally put it into what's called DFU mode, which is like for re-imaging the phone. And the phone is so hosed that every time iTunes tries to re-image it, it gives me an error. And worse, sometimes it's a different error. Like it's just a random error almost. So anyway, long story shorter, I ended up like, of course, stupidly trying to fix the problem myself for hours. And, finally went down, on Monday and, just went to the Apple store. I had tried so many different ways myself. I was really confident that they wouldn't be able to fix it either. And sure enough, they tried to reimage it a couple times and sent me out with a new phone. So that's great. New phone, but of course, as a developer and beta tester of iPhone software, that's kind of annoying because then you end up having to do new provisioning stuff.
Man. I thought we could go this 30 minutes without talking about provisioning.
Oh, it just sucks like too, because like people out there who are kind enough to let me beta test their software, they have very few slots, right? It's like you get 100 devices total.
Yep.
And then what happens is if somebody's device dies or gets traded in or they sell it, you got to use up another device ID if you want to keep that person as a tester.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, that's bad.
You know, I've got this one company I do, I'm a beta tester for, and they must be getting sick of me, man, because I had my iPhone, you know, 2G or whatever, and then I upgraded to a 3G, and then, you know, admittedly, at some point, they get to reuse or recycle, but, you know, recently, I had my phone stolen.
Right.
So I went from my 3GS stolen to a 3G, and then finally got the iPhone 4, and then trade in the iPhone 4. So I'm, like, burning up, like, four IDs. I'm like, maybe I should just let you guys know if I keep an ID for more than a couple months.
Wait before you send the new one, at least a couple weeks, right. Just in case.
It's frustrating.
Yeah, I think it was Craig Hockenberry, and I think a bunch of people have suggested this, but I think he was the first I saw that filed a bug on. They've got to tie this to like an Apple ID or some other, you know, way to tie these to a person and not a device, just a device ID.
Seriously, yeah. Because, I mean, they really just want to limit, you know, people using this as like a informal behind the, you know, backdoor sales thing.
Sure.
Or a backdoor distribution thing even without money. But seriously, if you were limited to, say, 100 Apple IDs, that would be fine. That would be good. Mm-hmm. And you could even have the Apple ID, you know, people, you know, manage their own list of approved devices then and say, like, I don't know. It is really dumb right now, and it's frustrating for the iPhone developers. I'm not looking forward to this aspect when I, you know, start beta testing my iPhone stuff. And, it's just like
it's a hassle.
It's a hassle. Anyway,
well, it's like we're used to, I mean, iPhone people who didn't build Mac software are sick of us saying this, but we're used to on the Mac where you just hit build and you send someone a release, you know, and then that's the standard I compare iPhone development too. And, you know, there are things, I don't know, like last week I had a problem with, I'll spare people the details because it's too painful, but basically like the team leader on the account changed and all the certificates became invalidated. And but they showed up as okay in the portal, and so I didn't think anything was wrong, but ended up having to just recreate everything. And it's a hassle. All right, so let's take some questions. We've got one from Scott Gould. He says, I was wondering if you'd speak about parsing strategies. It's always kind of tricky to know what will be coming in at you, so you have to have an account for such a wide variety of possible inputs, which creates some interesting challenges. Do you guys have any suggestions or strategies for doing file parsing? I'm not thinking of any specific file type, just in general. So, good question. I think when I think about this question, I think about mostly file formats, because I think is what he said, file parsing. And this issue, I think, is less of a problem than it used to be. It used to be everyone like created their own like funky binary file format, and then you had to move it between platforms, and you ran into trouble, and there was all sorts of problems you could run into, and your app would crash all the time when things were invalid. But now it's like everyone uses XML or JSON or something, and it seems like it's not a solved problem, but it seems like it's a lot better if you stick with a standard format and a standard parsing library. You don't have to worry about quite as many issues.
Yeah, you know what's funny though is it's interesting. I do a lot of XML stuff, as mm-hmm. you could guess. Sure. One of the funny things that's kind of a downside to this, or not a downside, but it's a gotcha, is so I'm parsing all this XML input, and I'm using the fantastic and free and bundled with macOS 10 library called libxml2, and this is wonderful until I get like a slightly aberrant XML document, you know? So mm-hmm. sometimes some blogs out there let users get like characters into their posts that are, for instance, not legal in XML. And so you sort of end up with this flip side of a totally standardized document that really, it's not my problem that it's an illegal XML document, but to make the experience good for the user, I should do something about that. So mm-hmm. it sort of introduces this problem where I think sometimes with these standardized file formats, even if you have a great parser, you sort of have to do your own pre-parsing or something, you know, I haven't actually solved this problem, this particular problem yet, but what I'm thinking is something like if the XML doesn't parse, then go in and try to like do some massage to say turn all the illegal characters into, you know, delete them or turn them mm-hmm. into markers or something that allows the processing to go through. But I guess that's just what I would, just because you mentioned, you know, the standardization, it's sort of depending on what kinds of inputs you are going to be getting, it doesn't necessarily get you off the hook for the weird stuff. And you know, Scott's question said it's tricky to know what will be coming in at you. And that's definitely true. It's if you've got like data from the wild, then I think that's, you know, one of the classic programming problems is, you know, what's coming in, how do you account for the most surprising stuff. Along these same lines, and to connect it to Cocoa programming in particular, you know, a lot of times you use something like, you know, if it's a roughly a string based format, you might want to use NSString to read in, say, the contents of a file and then parse what you get from that. And this is tricky, especially if the file in question doesn't have a standard encoding, right? So mm-hmm. let's say this actually bites me a little bit with the crossword app, because there is this completely custom, mostly text-based format, and then it has some like random, like, you know, non-legal in any encoding data characters in it as well. So for the most part, I can use NSString to like read subsections of the file, but I have to do this weird stuff like try to read it as a UTF-8 string. Oh, that didn't work. Yeah. And try to read it as a Windows string. And if that didn't work, then, you know, try to just read it in as a Mac Roman string or something, you know? And mm-hmm. I guess that's what I would boil it down to is, for whatever file type you're parsing, you might have to deal with there being like crap in there that's not even legally part of the file format. And then you might also need to deal with unspecified stuff where different people have made different assumptions. And that kind of thing can come down to like, oh, one person used a semi-standard file format but assumed that everybody reading the format would be a Windows box, and then another person assumed that everybody would be Linux, and so on. So I guess that's my take on it, is you just have to be really flexible, and this is a good opportunity probably to pump up the idea of unit testing when it comes to parsers, because these are the kinds of things where you're going to get a user's going to send you a funky file and say, you know, everything works great except for when I use this one file that I downloaded from this, you know, I don't know, like a Russian anime site or something, you know, and they'll be like, this has it has this one special like smiley face character in it that is not, you know, is not valid. And so what you'll do is you'll take that one file and you'll condense it down to a test case and cover it in your unit tests. And then you know that your parser will, you know, always work on that funky file. So that's my take.
And I think you, with blogging software, you have it particularly rough with this. Listening to you reminded me of that principle or phrase or whatever, the be liberal in what you accept and conservative in what you send out. You know, always be really, do the right thing, always send or save data in, you know, the best way you can. But then when you get data, you know, try to make the best of it, be flexible.
Yeah, that's a good strategy. And that's a good point. I imagine like a translator on you know, a foreign language. I don't know. It's tough, but you know, you're mm-hmm. listening to a foreign language interview or something. The person could be speaking in really cryptic, kind of like weird slang, but the translator is still, if they're speaking to you, Manton, in English, they're going to, mm-hmm. it's their obligation to translate that to pristine English that you can understand.
Yeah.
So I like that. That's something I'll be keeping in mind too. It's just like, it's the least I can do to make, you know, to make sure what I spit out is cleaner than what I read in.
Right. It's your duty. The other thing that comes to mind with parsing, I've recently, this isn't file, well, it could be file parsing, but I recently did some like search query parsing stuff. So you could do like advanced search queries in Clipstar, like this or this and this, with like parentheses and that kind of stuff. And I'm using a ParseKit from Todd Ditchendorf.
Yep.
I think is his last name. And he wrote Fluid and he's doing some other cool stuff. But I highly recommend that if you ever need to take, like my example, like a search query or, but anything. I mean, you can use it for parsing, you know, simple languages and, you know, all sorts of stuff, but it's very nice, really well designed. And I was able to plug it in really quickly and use it for what I needed to. Basically, if you need something that's like a really smart way to tokenize strings and break them up, it's pretty cool.
So we spent 10 minutes answering this question and you could have just answered it by saying, use ParseKit.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Good. Just wanted to clear that up. Next question. We have one coming in from Paul Crawford, who asks, I was wondering what you guys do in the way of advertising your products. Do you rely on Google traffic mostly, or do you use the ad networks such as Fusion? Or maybe some other form of promotion has been effective for you? What do you think, Manton? Are you advertising these days ever?
Oh, man, not really. I mean, I'll answer the second part first, which is, has any other form of promotion been effective? We've talked in previous shows about this a little bit. I ran a couple contests and promotions and stuff, which I think they're worth doing. I think once a year I'm going to try to do something like that, do a little giveaway or some little kind of PR thing. Because it gives bloggers and, you know, magazine writers and everybody an excuse to write something about your app, even if there's not a brand new version. You know, hopefully there is. If you have a brand new version and you're doing this little promotion, that's even better. But it gives them an excuse to write something. You know, their job is just to sit around trying to come up with interesting things for their readers. And, you know, you give them something that they can write about other than just a new version was released, blah, blah, blah. But for advertising, I don't do anything. I should. Like a couple days ago, I got a little thing from Google AdWords, like an email saying, we noticed you haven't been using AdWords lately. Here's $100, you know, head start to to start, you know, using it. And I was like, oh, cool, I need to do this again, because I had tried some AdWords and it kind of flopped. And I logged in. Of course, the UI is completely different, and I don't live in the AdWords interface. So I was like, okay, I've got to spend a couple hours figuring out how to set up all these campaigns again. So I should do more, but I just don't right now. I don't have the mental bandwidth to deal with it.
Yeah, I'm pretty hesitant to advertise, because I just don't feel confident that I know yet what will be effective. And of course, advertising usually comes with an upfront or at least as you go immediate cost. And I have done a little Google Ads. I've been beating myself up though for years to like actually get the analytics set up so that you can, you know, gauge what the conversion rates are, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't feel too confident even about Google Ads until I get something in there that I could say, you know, for every $5 I spend on Google Ads, it's making me $10 or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then even that, you know, even when you are making a return that shows that you're not losing money on advertising, I think it's still questionably valuable, because you don't really know. I don't know. It's complicated, because you kind of like have to then second guess like whether you're getting those customers in a really inefficient manner, whether it would be more worth your time to find out a better marketing message or to get better, free buzz on the internet, whether you should be doing more direct marketing to your existing customer base, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I'm really tepid about advertising, especially because I don't know much about advertising, but I know enough to have heard sort of the rules of thumb about needing to, there's a reason they call advertising, that they classify it into discrete periods of time called like campaigns. And it's because, as I understand it, advertising is pretty worthless unless you are sort of like, repeatedly hitting people with the same message. All right. So this is why, Ford doesn't buy like one ad on TV and say, oh, well, I'm pretty sure that Daniel and Manton saw our ad, so if they're interested, they will certainly consider Ford. So that whole phenomenon scares me a little bit too, that I have to like have some kind of systematic, like relentless effort to get stuff in front of people. And when people ask me this in other venues, like whether I advertise, if so, if not, why not? One of the things I fall back on is I sort of have had such good luck with the soft marketing, the being present on Twitter, the trying to be part of communities, that I'm not sure. I would definitely say I'd rather have all of that than even an extra, say, $25,000 a year to pay for advertising. I think what I have in terms of, blogging buzz and Twitter buzz and word of mouth is definitely worth more to me than, say, $25,000 in advertising.
Yeah.
But what does that mean, really? Does that mean I shouldn't be advertising? I don't know. But it means that trying to keep that momentum going, that like word of mouth, that sort of just like feel good feeling about the company and my products is more important to me than advertising. So I sort of think advertising is more important and more appropriate the bigger your company gets.
Yeah, I can believe that. And I definitely think making like a personal connection like you do with your blog and Twitter and everything else is way more valuable than just some random ad that gets thrown up on the screen. When you were talking about direct marketing, and it reminded me of a post that TapTapTap made a couple days ago about their iPhone app Camera Plus. And they made a point to say, we didn't do a traditional advertising this time. We gave away like a whole bunch of camera gear. I think it was worth like, $10,000 or something. And then we sent an email out to our targeted list, and then we let it spread, from word of mouth. And in the app, I'm sure they have like a like press here and tell your friends you're using this kind of thing. But I'll link that up in the show notes. It was kind of interesting because it was like wildly successful. They made like 200 grand in the first month or something.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's the thing is advertising is, I think they're trying to figure out how to make it work with the new way that people behave online. And I think some of the stuff like the, like Paul, the question asked about Fusion, which is like integrated into apps like Twitterific and such. I think that's the kind of thing people are trying now is how do you do that? Obviously Apple with their iAds is going big time into this sort of integrated into the app advertising.
You know, and that's another thing. Another reason maybe that I'm hesitant to advertise is that I don't like ads. Like I never want to have my products be ad supported. I know there's a lot of people that, especially now with iAds, they're going to rely on iAds for pretty much all or a significant portion of the revenue for their apps. And that's fine. If it works for them, that's great. But I'm just not a fan of that. I'd rather people pay me money and I will make the product better and I will give the product to them in exchange for that money. And so I think that's another reason why I've been hesitant to just like really embrace advertising because I'm just not a fan of the ad-supported model.
That is a great point. I don't really see myself that way either. And I think that's one of the things that I keep coming back to as an indie developer on the Mac, on the iPhone, on the iPad, you know, in this Apple sphere. It's come back to me repeatedly that I'm not just in this for the money. And I am always trying to kind of balance like, well, I should be doing that if I want to make money. And, and then I think, well, if I wanted to make money, I would be like, writing, you know, spam sending software or something, you know, or I'd be like making, I don't know, stock market analysis tools for PCs, right. You know? Yeah. But I want to do something more interesting than that. And, it's constantly sort of like, an issue for me, like, well, should I do that? Or should I be like above the fray and just do it my way because I want to do it my way. And, it's a constant struggle to figure out like what balance to give to the just cold, hard making money aspect, because obviously I want to keep, you know, making enough money that I can, you know, so to speak, keep the dream alive. But, I agree with you. That is an important, part of it. Do you like that? Do you like advertising? Do you like ads in your app? That's another angle where it's like, you know, I think the Fusion ads people are doing something pretty cool. And for people who want to support their own apps that way, that's great. But I don't see it for me. This also comes back to the whole like the bundle promotions, you know, Mac Heist and various bundles that come up over time. We've talked about this before. Like it might make me rich to be a part of it. But before that happens, I have to decide that I like the idea of being a part of it. So until I resolve all of that, I'll just be here in my apartment wishing I could buy a house. Anyway.
All right. Well, that's a show. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time, I guess.
Sounds good. Talk to you later, Manton.
Bye.